Hey, it's Greg. Thanks very much for checking out Toronto today for this Monday, July 25th. Well, we're picking up after a bit of a stormy night, but a forecast ahead that's very mild, at least compared to the last few weeks of sticky heat, humidity, Humidex readings, other H words. So better weather if you're more on the moderate side of what you want from your temperature. Two big stories, kind of to advance. One is the Pope's visit to Canada. He arrived on Sunday. And just the bottom line is we're not going to find uniformity on this. We're not going to get close to a unanimous verdict as to whether the apology that he'll give several times over should be accepted, whether he should even have made the trip or not. All that is going to be divisive, and we can expect that. And I think it's okay that it is. And we'll advance the Hockey Canada hearings at House of Commons tomorrow. Dan Robson from The Athletic joins us to do that. Toronto Today for Monday begins now. Let me start here because it's going to be some big stories, I think, this week that grow throughout the week. This will certainly be one of them. The Pope doesn't come to Canada very often, and this one, it's his first visit. And I'm going to say a couple things about this that are really irrespective of the issue at hand. And I'm going to get to the issue at hand. Don't worry about that. I'm impressed he came. I'm impressed he made it. He's 85 years old. There were rumors as recently as 5-6 weeks ago that he'd be stepping down at a certain point in time. He's got awful knees. He's got really, really bad knees. Not just 85-year-old knees, but below average knees for an 85-year-old human being. And he flew 10 and a half hours. I get it. He's not cramped on a WestJet flight in seat 32C. He's not in coach, okay? Next to a family that's trying to connect in Tampa so they can go to the Dominican Republic. I got it. He flies in luxury and he flies in style, but he's still doing the flying. And he's 85 years old, has to be wheeled to and from places, okay? And walks with quite a large cane when he walks at all, and that's not for more than 7-8 meters at a time. That was my observation from yesterday, and the observation of there's obviously a core that travels with him on a regular basis and covers all things pontiff related and all things Catholic Church related. Now, don't say to me, hey, he should be, I know he should be here. I'm just saying I'm impressed from a physical perspective that he didn't cancel. He had a trip to Africa, by the way, that he's ended up canceling. By the way, do you think that the Catholic Church has any reparations or apologies to make for things that they've done on the continent of Africa for centuries before? I would make the case that they do. But this one is prominent right now, and this one matters to us. So here's what's going to happen. Nothing gets universal approval in this day and age. Nothing does. Politics-wise, healthcare-wise, entertainment, sport, doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. We can't agree even to disagree on some things. We just sometimes go our separate ways if we can't find common ground. And there are people that want the Pope in Canada to give this apology. There are people that are floored that it's happening, never thought they'd see it in their lifetime. And there's people that don't want him here at all, that say an apology means zip to me. It means zero to me. Maybe you saw the movie Spotlight when it came out. Big film, right? 2019 Academy Award winner. You got big A-listers galore. Michael Keaton, Mark Ruffalo, Rachel McAdams, Canada's own, Ontario's own, London's own, I think. I always get her and Bieber confused, but I think she's a Londoner and Beeford is a Stratfordite, whatever. But when you watch Spotlight, you realize two things about molestation and the Catholic Church. One, it's whatever you think about its widespread nature, it's more widespread than you think. The second part is people point to things like criminal background checks and a vetting process that clearly doesn't work. No, most people who are going to be abusers, serial abusers, don't have a criminal record. Why? They're craven about staying on the safe side of getting caught. They're not gonna have too many break and enters if you're a Catholic priest and you're abusing young boys. And this was happening. And this has happened. And we know for residential schools, it's not just about abuse. It's not just sexual abuse, not just physical abuse. It's a culture of intimidation.
it's a culture of, quote, end quote, beating the Indian out of its residents. It's terrible. And we all miss this. And well, I often say, as someone born in the 70s, kid of the 80s, got my university education in the 90s, I don't like you laying everything at my doorstep, but I'll take what's mine. And I don't know how we could have pushed more for this to be in our curriculum in school. And I don't know how we could have pushed more for universities to give us a better understanding of what this was. We're wasting. Listen, I have great respect for university. I wouldn't give up my years in university for anything. I do hope my two sons attend university. I think it can round you out as people and you can evolve from it. College, same thing. But we missed a lot of stuff. And I know how guilty my parents feel. And if you're in your 40s and 50s, your parents might feel the same way for just missing residential schools in Canada. So we aren't going to know exactly how this is going to go until it goes a certain way. Predictions about how the community embraces Pope Francis, predictions about how far the apology goes, are kind of a dime a dozen. And I don't know how worthy they are instead of worthless. There were so many sins pushed upon Indigenous people in residential school harm. And there's two different things that we look for here. One is accountability, and two is a deep understanding that we had to do better and we missed windows of opportunity to do better. And I don't know what the word forgiveness, I was thinking about it last night and channeling my thoughts through just writing them down to myself. Forgiveness means a lot of things to a lot of different people. Accidents are like that too. Well, or mistakes, excuse me, not accidents. I made a mistake. Well, planning a crime and committing a crime isn't a mistake. It's not a mistake to abuse someone. It's a decision to abuse someone. It's not a mistake to cuff somebody in the head hard and hit them with a ruler or give them lashes on their hand because you heard them speak their native language, whether it's Cree, Ojibwe, whatever it is, and you only want them speaking English. That's not a mistake. And when I say I don't believe in second chances sometimes, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Exactly what I'm talking about. Let me hear from George Arcan Jr. I'll explain who he is. He's a grand chief from the Alexander First Nation and was the CEO of Fort McKay First Nation. He makes the point that this is what he's hoping for from the Pope's visit.
Come in, talk and apologize to our survivors so that we could begin our journey of healing and that we can begin the opportunity to change the way things have been for our people for many, many years.
This is where I hope we can find some common ground here. Arcan Jr. is looking forward to this and wants, peace, a peaceful visit and to find more common ground and reconciliation. And others do not. And I think each side has to respect each other here. If this isn't for you, fine. It's not for you right now. Okay? This was deemed by Pope Francis as a, quote, penitential trip. He knows he's got to apologize. He knows he has to step up, okay, metaphorically, and advance the cause here. This has been needed for a long time. There was no name on this couple interviewed by Global News in Edmonton. They plan to go to the Pope's speech tomorrow, more a mass at Commonwealth Stadium where the Elks play. 60,000 people are going to be there. But this was their thought. But this, again, sometimes it's not just about you, Catholic couple here. This is a noted Catholic couple that wants this to go a certain way.
We have been praying for weeks now that it's going to be a really good visit for the Pope, that he'll be welcomed, and that there will be a spirit of reconciliation like we haven't seen before.
Okay, sure. I mean, I can want that too, but it has to be a two-way street. It must be a two-way street, and you're just going to have to understand if some people don't want the apology. If some people are of the mind that it's way too little and far too late, okay? This is common ground here, okay? This is common among issues like this. It's too late. The damage has been done. Talk to the hand. I'm not interested. And there will be some people that have more of a heart of forgiveness. And to me, neither is right, neither is wrong. In this particular case, anyway, neither is right and neither is wrong. Okay? But again, let's be clear about what mistakes are and what decisions are, what accidents are, and what purposeful, systematic abuse ends up being. Let's be clear about what those things are. We're going to have an Indigenous leader named Perry Omiasu on the show a little later on in the week, on Wednesday, as a matter of fact. This is what he said to Global News about the pending visit.
I had a good spiritual kind of upbringing, and then they took me away from that and put me into Indian residential school. And what a change. What a difficult and ugly change in my life. I didn't know how to speak any English till I got there. And my cousin said, don't get caught speaking Cree or you're going to get hit. For like a year, you know, I hardly spoke to anybody. I felt so alone.
And Perry says this apology is not for me. He's not that interested. A really interesting part of the story is a road got paved that the Pope's cars will drive down, the security detail, his supporters, his aides. And the First Nations community in that area has been asking for that road to be paved for decades. The Pope comes and snap of a finger, they do it. So you can understand. I thought that was really prominent in my mind and my heart thinking, there's something wrong with that, okay? Clean drinking water. We've been talking about this and the federal government, and this is not the only federal government, not to get to it, for years and years and years, okay? I don't think the Pope's exactly going to be drinking from First Nations taps or drinking out of one of those jugs, because clean drinking water isn't coming out of the taps and the water's not safe to cook with, bathe with, or drink. Passports have been a major issue. They've been a major topic. To say it's gone smoothly to get one is not true. It's getting better. It does indeed seem. I want to bring on the Honorable Karina Gould, who's the Minister of Families, Children, and Social Development. She's also been MP in Burlington since 2015. Karina, thank you very much for coming on. Good morning.
Good morning, Greg.
Yeah, it's great to have you. It looks to me, and I know this has gotten some, sometimes good news doesn't travel as fast as bad news, but passport applications are now down. And that's a positive in that it probably means to me that more people are getting served and the backlogs, the long waiting, that seems to be getting minimized now. What does the data tell you?
Yeah, so you're not wrong. Things are getting better. They're still not where we need to be on passports, but things are getting a lot better, particularly at passport offices. I think folks around the GTA will note that, even though there's still long lineups, those lines are moving pretty quickly. We have teams of managers in place right around the GTA at all of the passport offices as of 7 a.m. To do the triage. So people don't actually have to get there bright and early. We'll actually see people throughout the day. So that, has been better. And we're triaging people based on date of travel. So, if you're traveling within the next 48 hours, you're going to get your passport on time, unless there's some other extenuating circumstance. And then, if you're traveling later, we're giving people appointments to come back so they don't have to do those lineups. And every week we see an increased number of passports that are being issued across the country. So that's good. So we're trending in the right direction.
When did it become obvious to you that this was going to be, I suppose, an issue in that things would stabilize somewhat with regard to our entire country's COVID situation, based on individual household, but a lot of people who'd been sitting on ideas to travel or just the idea to renew the passport, we were going to have a flood. We were going to have a bit of a rush to get those documents updated. When did it seem to you like we're going to need to really, increase the manner in which we to expedite this process?
So I would say April, and that's why, and that might seem like, well, if you knew about this April, why are we here now? Part of it is because it takes about 12 to 15 weeks to train passport officers. So we began hiring a whole new cohort of passport officers last April that are coming on board now, but we've been trying to pivot and readjust since travel restrictions were lifted. We had kind of two things happen at the same time, which really came to a head in April, but we really realized the impact in May, was that at the end of March, beginning of April, as travel restrictions were lifted, we got a huge influx of people applying for their passport through the mail channel, which we don't normally get, at the same time as we got a lot of people seeking urgent passport requests at passport offices because they were had maybe been a bit excited, booked their travel once the restrictions were lifted, but didn't have a passport. And those two things, which would have been challenging if just one had happened, happened at the same time and really kind of caused both the long lineup, the passport offices, but also the backlog. But I actually have some good news today in the GTA in that two additional offices are going to have passport pickup services. So in Brampton and in Whitby. So even though those are passport offices, you can't actually pick up your passport until today at those offices. And that will help ease some of the congestion in other parts around Toronto.
Karina Gould is our guest on Toronto Today, Liberal MP. And we're talking about the passport crisis. Do you know the ratio of how many people try to do it via mail and how many people do show up in person? Because it strikes me it came as a self-fulfilling prophecy that, like you said, people just left too small a window, showed up in person, and then there was a lot more of a glut in the in-person waiting than there was if you did. I've been that person before where I've had to hustle to an office to do it because I didn't do it in time and do it via mail.
Yeah, so back in March and April, it was about 80% that went via mail and about 20% in person. And now it's still about 60% by mail and about 40% in person. So we can actually manage the in-person services fairly well because it's much more efficient. The mail channel is a lot less efficient. And so what we see is, 25 to 30% of the applications that we're getting in the mail have errors that we have to then send back or contact someone. But so it really adds to the delays. And so we're actually trying to increase in-person service because pre-pandemic, we would have had about 80% coming to an office and only about 20% going through the mail channel. And, even if that was not seeking an urgent passport, it was just going in, dropping off your application and waiting for your passport to be mailed back to you. And what we're seeing is that now right across the country, you can go to any Service Canada center to drop off your application instead of sending it through the mail, which is a lot better because someone can check it, make sure everything is correct, and then you keep your original documents. You don't have to send anything away. So really trying to encourage people, if you don't have urgent travel, go to a Service Canada center. They can review everything, check it over, make sure everything is in order before it gets entered into the system. And if you do have urgent travel, to really get to one of those passport offices.
Karina Gould is our guest on Toronto Today. She's a Minister of Families, Children and Social Development. She's on Toronto Today with Greg Brady. I'm sure there's been some sleepless nights with this portfolio. I've said that about Omar Al-Ghabra. These are not easy cabinet positions in a pandemic when everybody wants something and they want it now. But I'd ask you if you think, do we have a little bit of a build back with in terms of our reputation? Do we have a build back to do? Has there been any short-term damage done to, the ability to travel, to the idea that Canada is efficient, easy to get in and out of? Is there work needs to be done here, Karina?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Look, we're not the only ones in the world who are facing this issue. I mean, the UK, the US, Australia, France, Sweden, they also have, months-long waits now for passports. I think the whole world thought that travel wouldn't rebound as quickly and was planning as such. But that being said, we shouldn't be in this position and we shouldn't have been in this position. And so there is a lot of learning, I think, that I certainly have done and continue to do. But I also am looking to to modernize the passport system, right? We don't currently have the ability to apply online to renew a passport. We're going to change that just for renewals. We're not going to do that for first-time passport holders because we still need to make sure we need to maintain the integrity in the process in that regard. But we can do things better. And that's where, the additional ability to now pick up passports in Brampton and Whitby will help. And we're going to roll that out throughout the country. There are just things we can do better. This crisis has really put that, into clear view for us. And we're going to make those changes. And we already are.
I know as families minister how hard you had to work and did work to get the provinces their child care deals. And I wanted to ask you about that, given there was a stat last week and we documented it on the show, how there's a lot of child care operators that haven't opted in to participate in the $10 a day child care program. Now, I don't know if that's simple supply and demand. If people are parents are paying and they're full with daycare spots, maybe there isn't a lot of incentive to do it, but that's a little disappointing because it doesn't lower the cost for the average family. What are you hearing? And again, being an Ontarian, what are you hearing about where we're at with the province for eligible kids for this? There's obviously some poor for-profit operators that haven't pushed in so far and made it less expensive for parents to send their kids to daycare.
Yeah. So look, I guess, I've seen this play out across the country. And what I would say is that remember that Ontario was the last province to sign on, and they signed on, you know, in some cases almost 9 months later than the rest of the provinces. So the other provinces and territories had much more of a head start when it came to signing, you know, to rolling out their initiatives and getting people signed on. And what I've seen in other jurisdictions is that kind of by the deadline to sign on, you get like 90-95% of operators who do sign on. There's always a bit of noise in the system when you're creating something new. And Ontario is you know, later to get to the game than others were. So they're already behind. That being said, I know that, you know, the province is working really hard to get folks signed up by September 1st. So they do have until September 1st. The other complication in Ontario is it's not the province that manages it, but they kind of download it to municipalities. So municipalities and providers got the same information at the same time. And so, you know, providers have to work with those municipalities. But again, what I have seen in other jurisdictions is that once that engagement and dialogue happens, you know, there's some misinformation that's out there that, you know, people are going to go out of business. Yeah. Well, we haven't seen that in any other province or territory, so we're not going to see that in Ontario either, right? Like, the whole idea here is to make sure that we can lower those costs. This is a great opportunity for families, and actually it's a great opportunity for providers too, because it's about building a better future for our children. So I think that continued engagement needs to happen. You know, really hear people out, understand what their concerns are, and also allay some of those concerns because there are some rumors flying around that, like, are just not going to happen. But at the end of the day, I think it's going to be positive, and there's always going to be a few people who decide not to participate. That's fine. But what we have seen, generally speaking, across the country is, you know, well over 90% of providers do sign on.
Yeah, let's hope we get there. And like you said, the fall is kind of the crunch time to get that done. Karina, thank you very much for the time today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Karina Gould is Minister of Families, Children, and Social Development. Mike Moffitt, Dr. Mike Moffitt joins me right now. I wanted to start with talking. You had a business trip to Chicago a while back, and I find it fascinating because I think Toronto and Chicago often get compared as cities. I know people sometimes link us with New York, maybe with London. I think Chicago is a more apt comparison because there's a waterfront, because traffic comes to a standstill. What do you see, Mike, in Chicago, Illinois, that would work in Toronto that we just haven't implemented? Maybe it's too late to even implement.
Well, I think the focus on the waterfront, and I think Toronto's getting there. We've seen a lot of investments over the waterfront, but, you know, just going down that 18-mile trail in Chicago, going past Navy Pier, you know, the amount of emphasis that the city puts on the waterfront, and they're quite proud of it, and rightfully so. So I think Toronto's moving in the right direction, but I would agree that the two cities are very, very similar. The one thing I would love to see more of Toronto is just pride in the city. You know, there's an energy when you go to Chicago. You know, people from Chicago will tell you that they're from Chicago, whether or not you want to hear it. You know, there's just that pride there that I don't think we have as much of in Canada. You know, maybe it's just, Canadian politeness. I'm not sure. But just that energy that you get in Chicago is fantastic, and I would love to see more of it here.
Well, it's a weird one, too, because did you fly into O'Hare or did you fly into Midway? Have you flown into Midway before?
So I flew into Midway, but yeah. I have been to both. O'Hare can be a bit of a nightmare at times, but then again, so can Pearson. So,
well, that's what I wondered, because Thursday, and then Pierre Poilievre being on, he was on our show Friday, but Thursday he made the point about this is what we can do with Billy Bishop Airport, and you know, he ruffled some feathers, but he got people to pay attention to the idea, and I thought that's what serves Chicago so well, is O'Hare can be every bit the logistical nightmare and time suck that Pearson is. But Midway is a wonderful alternative that you can fly in there from almost anywhere. But with Billy Bishop, we're really limited in terms of flights. And I'm like, I thought about that. And I'm like, there's two, you know, existing airports that work actually almost hand in hand together, and that might be something to aspire to for a city like Toronto. I think we clearly need something else other than 98% of flights originating from Pearson.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that as well. I mean, there's been talk for decades about putting another large airport in Pickering to, you know, get the sort of west, east side of Toronto taken care of. But I agree that we are sort of running into these bottlenecks. And the flight I took from Chicago was from Billy Bishop to Midway. And it was fantastic to be able to avoid those large international airports and be able to take more of a regional route.
Like, I always think about Billy Bishop, Mike. I think that's too small for them to even lose your bag. If they lost your bag, you'd see it on the other side of the airport. It's flights aren't delayed. It doesn't take long to walk there. Now there's an underground walkway they built in 2015. Like, the first time you fly Porter, and it sounds like we're corporately shilling, you just don't want to go back. You found, you know, air traveler heaven.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm a big fan of smaller airlines for that reason. Because, yeah, absolutely. You could, if they misplace your bag, you go, oh, it's just over there on the runway. Can you go out and get somebody to find it? So, yeah, absolutely. I think there is something to be said of not rooting everything into these large, massive airports that can be impersonal at the best of times.
Dr. Mike Moffitt joining us on Toronto Today. You made a point of commenting on a tweet from the NDP leader, and I'll read people the tweet. Ottawa elites are enraged by the NDP proposal to send inflation relief to struggling families, but silent when billions in corporate welfare are handed out because they view workers with contempt and corporations with admiration. I believe government should be on the side of workers. A lot of people, I mean, it's one thing for a politician's tweets to get ratioed, but that there may be a bit of a pre-bias towards that. But you made the point a few others had. We gotta clean up our language, as it were. Not that that's raw or visceral, but Ottawa elites almost adds fuel to the fire. Some of what we saw in January and February.
Well, absolutely, and it was interesting for me to see the backlash from the progressive side of Ottawa. So it was Ariel Troster, who's running for city council in downtown Ottawa. Mm-hmm. You know, definitely left of center. She highlighted this, and you know, when the complaints are coming from within the house, that this is an issue. You know, people who live in downtown Ottawa are a bit on edge right now, and have been for the last 6 months. So, you know, think about it. You're a worker. You work at the Rideau Center, at the Chipotle. You know, you keep missing shifts. You have to deal with all of this nonsense, and then to be told by the leader of the NDP, "Oh, well, you're an Ottawa elite." I think it just rubbed people the wrong way. We get what he was trying to say, but you know, my God, when we're kind of under siege here, could you just, you know, frame things a little bit better? And again, the biggest complaints were from people who would normally vote NDP.
Yeah, I even feel like it happened. You can imagine it happens here in Toronto. And I'm like, you're telling me somebody who waits tables, who busts it 45 hours a week, makes $18 an hour, has to pay $1,600 for rent a month. That's an elite? Like times have changed if that's an elite compared to when we were in university.
Yeah, absolutely. And we see that here. Like Ottawa Center, so sort of downtown Ottawa, you know, we have, I think, the highest rate, or close to the highest rate of service workers in Canada as a proportion of the population, because it's all, you know, people who work at restaurants, people who work at the NEC and so on. And those aren't, you know, generally speaking, very high paid jobs. And Ottawa is not Toronto, but it's still not the cheapest city in Canada to live in. So, you know, to then be told like, oh, you're an elite and you're only shilling for corporations. It really rubs people the wrong way up here.
Yeah, there must be something with the language. I got under a minute, but there must be something with the language. And Polyev's connecting with his use of, we're rolling our eyes a little bit when he mentions the gatekeepers. Well, we do need rules and regulations in corporations and in business and in travel, but there is that element. And I remember the prime minister the Wednesday before the Freedom Convoy came in with the small, fringe minority. And I'm like, oh gosh, it's just gas on fire these days. It just is.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right that this is coming from all sides. You know, mm-hmm. there's not one political party that is sort of exempt from this. And I share your frustration. I would absolutely love to see a politician come in and look to unite people and, turn the temperature down on this because people are on edge right now. It's been a difficult 2.5 years. So just moderate your tone and try and bring people together rather than using this kind of inflammatory language.
Love it. Dr. Mike Moffitt, Senior Director, Smart Prosperity. Got to leave it there, but I love our conversations. Thanks for getting up early for it and have a great week.
You too. Take care.
It's something to keep an eye on today for sure. Pope Francis arrived in Canada yesterday. Just the third ever visit by a pope to Canada. That to me is going to surprise some people. I wouldn't have said that. And Pope John Paul II, who had the long run as pope, quite obviously, from the late 70s all the way, a few years into the century we're in now, came into Canada in 1984, came back in 1987. He came when John Turner was prime minister on an interim basis, came when Brian Mulroney was obviously prime minister in 87, and then in 2002. And Pope Francis makes his first visit to Canada here. So this is new. And he's here for a specific reason, no doubt, to apologize to the Indigenous people of Canada for the role of the Catholic Church in the Canadian residential school system. We talked about it in the 7 o'clock hour, 6 o'clock hour. And it's obviously something not everyone's going to agree on. Not everyone wants the apology, but some people are grateful for it. Some people thought they'd never see it, and they're going to get to now. I want to bring on Jonathan Hamilton Dibo, Assistant Professor of Theology and Special Advisor on Indigenous Initiatives at Victoria University at U of T. Jonathan is a Mohawk from Konakwe, a First Nations community outside of Montreal, and we're talking to him in Alberta this morning. So, Jonathan, I appreciate you getting up really early for us on an important issue, but thank you nonetheless.
Thank you very much, Greg. I appreciate the invitation to speaking today.
Of course. It's expectations vary, and the desire, as I mentioned in introducing you, vary. Probably we won't come to a consensus by the end of the week. Do you just see it as, hey, this is there for some people if they want it, and other people will just not accept an apology, and will just say it's far too little and far too late?
Yeah, exactly. We're going to get from community members and individuals so many different responses. I think what is important to focus in on, despite how people feel about this, is that he is here for the survivors. And I think what's important is to remember what this means to the survivors. For those who had family members that went through that, this will impact them as well. And again, even within that group, it's not going to be a consensus on how they're going to respond.
You mentioned in your piece on The Conversation, which is a great read, that you're a Mohawk raised in Catholic tradition. And obviously, you've studied and been successful studying at a theological school. What does that do for your lens? Not necessarily to see all sides of this issue, Jonathan, but what does that do to broaden your ability to have conversations about this?
Well, I think growing up in my community and also, as you mentioned, studying and now teaching within the theological school, Emmanuel College, I think what it's allowed me to do, as you mentioned, I get to see other sides, but I can bring that conversation forward. A lot of times, I think what happens is many people make assumptions largely about Indigenous people and communities and their reaction to the church. And I do find that not necessarily within the community, but outside the community, many are surprised to hear how could Indigenous people be part of the church, especially when this happened to you. And I think this really makes an interesting conversation. And it also had me, quite honestly, raise a lot of questions for myself about being part of something that you think, oh, okay, I do need to be realistic about, you know, if I belong to a church community, what does that mean for me? And then how do I think about that? So I that really, for me, was something that I had to tackle, that challenged me. But I think how I look at it at the end from my personal experience is that I look at it from a difference of the faith versus the church as a body or organization. I try to kind of look at it that way.
Mm. Jonathan Hamilton Dibo is our guest, assistant professor of theology, special advisor on Indigenous initiatives at Victoria University in the University of Toronto. I'm glad you brought that up, because I think the lens, and unfortunately, I do think we're kind of guilty of it in the media. I know that politicians sometimes do this. They look for consensus where there just isn't going to be any. I've watched people argue of, I've watched black friends of mine argue about the N-word and when to use and when not to. And I just sit there and I watch and I listen and I try and learn. And I've watched, people just say, this is for me, but it may not be for someone else that looks like me or comes from where I come from. Like, this is going to be an almost impossible issue, as we were saying in the beginning, to gain some form of consensus on as to whether an apology is accepted or whether the Pope should be here.
Yes. The consensus aspect there, or looking for one answer, is always a simple way. And I think what we've seen, in particular since the TRC, but also prior to that, is that we're dealing with various communities, various nations, different ways of looking at the world. And from community to community, that really changes. And so when you try to get this one voice, one view, I think people want to deal with that than trying to understand the diversity that exists. And so you're right. When it comes to the consensus component, there is none. And I think this is why it's so important to have these kind of conversations and to learn more about the differences of how people are going to see something. At the end, from my perspective, as someone who's been raised in the Catholic Church, who's been part of a United Church theological school and in other alt denominations, what I've learned is to appreciate other viewpoints and respect them, and not to kind of impose my own belief systems on others, but to understand why maybe a person feels a particular way, especially around this topic on the church and the relationships and why do they distrust it. And I just have to listen. And I think that's really kind of what's key in all this is listening to each other.
Saying that, and I agree with what you said, I feel the generation that came before us, my parents born in the 40s, people listening who might be older or those who had parents born in the 50s, they missed this. And what I mean by that is they missed the residential school's existence, and they missed the far more egregious things and the terrible things that were going on at these schools. And they feel, I can tell from conversations with my own parents who both were teachers, they feel guilty about it. And opinions have evolved on a lot of other fronts. They probably, maybe when they got married in 1967, they wouldn't have believed in, you know, gay marriage. And maybe they wouldn't have believed in this, that, or the other thing. And we're supposed to evolve as we grow. But I would say, and I want to know if you feel this, like this sort of resonates with you, that the generation before me and you really missed this as something they should have. Either you can't speak out about something if you don't know about it. Do you feel that's a common sentiment among people of that age in their 60s and 70s? They just didn't know.
They didn't know. And when you think about, you know, the education system, it wasn't taught. And from my own experience, and I grew up in Montreal, because my community, Ganawag, is right there. For me, what was interesting was that what I learned about history was something more along the lines of, well, when people first start coming to North America, they're indigenous people, there was the fur trade, and then it moves on, and there's really very little mention about Indigenous contribution whatsoever. So forget about the fact that residential schools are not even mentioned. The whole aspect of interactions and how Indigenous people contributed to the formation of Canada completely is just omitted. So in the sense, it's not been part of our school system. It's not been part of kind of this dialogue. Now within First Nation communities, those stories are always there. Just what happened now is that, you know, after 2015, the stories came out in the sense that Canada was now listening. There were other times in 1996 with the Royal Commission of Aboriginal Peoples. It was spoken about there in other places, but people really start to listen in 2015 afterwards. So I think you're right, that whole aspect of guilt and why didn't we know this? But again, if it was known, and I remember reading this, and I can't remember exactly where, but people just thought, well, I lived across the street from them and I saw it was a school for Indian children and they looked like they were being taken care of. And that was kind of what they knew. Or sometimes that was the story being sent out to people as well.
Yeah.
So again, I think with previous generations and even, you know, students that I teach now, they said, I wish I knew this earlier.
Yeah. And you made the great point that now their kitchen table discussions, their what did you learn in school today? This is what I learned. And that eluded us when we went to school. Jonathan, thanks so much for the time. Your piece on the conversation is great. And I know you'll be watching this week with interest. I hope we can chat again.
Me too. Thank you very much.
You got it. Jonathan Hamilton Dibo is Assistant Professor of Theology, Special Advisor on Indigenous Initiatives at Victoria University at U of T. And you can read his piece on his opinion piece on theconversation.com. Hockey Canada executives are back in front of a committee of Canadian MPs tomorrow. The NDP MP Peter Julians is part of this. Remember, the last time they visited in Ottawa, their funding was frozen a day or two later, and this started an avalanche of withdrawal of corporate support. This started more details, lawyers involved with the eight players, lawyers for seven of the eight players, alleged to have assaulted a woman in a London hotel room back in 2018. She was paid a settlement in April of this year. And then we find out on Friday, about an alleged assault, Rick Westhead. There's only one Rick Westhead, we acknowledge that, from TSN busted this open on Friday about a videotaped assault, which doesn't seem to have any gray area as to whether it was consensual or not. The details were harrowing, involving the 0203 World Junior team while they were in Halifax. And two shining examples of journalism all week long to me, I mentioned Rick Westhead already, were Robin Doolittle, Grant Robertson, and the team at the Globe and Mail with what they were able to bust open with Hockey Canada's special multi-million-dollar fund. They used registration fees of players across the country to pay out alleged sexual assault settlements. And what we read in The Athletic with Ian Mendez, Katie Strang, and our next guest, Dan Robson. Dan, it's great to have you on. Thanks very much. Not easy journalism to do, but I thought it was really prominent. I thought what the three of you put together with some of the details in London, some of the investigative work was phenomenal, and I credit you for it.
Well, thanks very much for having me, Greg. I really appreciate you reading that piece.
Yeah. What are you expecting tomorrow? We just have a lot more of a lens. I mean, you would have been following it closely. I would have been following it closely when Tom Rennie and company went to Ottawa 5 weeks ago now. We know a lot more. We know a lot more. And I think the outrage in the country is just at a much higher pitch than it was when they went the first time.
Yeah, I described that first time as a grilling. And I think it was something that it appeared that the Hockey Canada executives there weren't quite expecting. And I think we're going to see more of that this week over 2 days. And there's others coming to be questioned as well, basically regarding the state of Hockey Canada and hockey, junior hockey across this country, and also specifically about these allegations. You mentioned now the new emergence of what is alleged to have occurred in 2003. So it's going to be just 2 days of very uncomfortable questions being asked and hopefully some answers being given.
Dan Robson joining us from The Athletic on Toronto Today. What's the biggest criticism of Hockey Canada from most people you speak to? Is it more how they've reacted since these allegations and revelations have taken place? Or is it all the before, that they were operating within a vacuum, not, you know, walking the walk, not making individuals accountable? Or is it the subsequent reaction, which has seen very little in terms of change or resignation or turnover or just a rebrand or a reboot?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, I think that what we're seeing now is a reality of the former, of the fact that for so long, hockey and the governing body within hockey has sort of existed in a vacuum with sort of internal repercussions and trying to deal with things very quietly, make things go away. Or so it would seem in particular, particularly dealing with this case from 2018 that was settled back in April. You know, now, you know, we're relatively soon into this process. I mean, Hockey Canada is saying that they're trying to make changes. They're looking into what they can do. They've you know, signed on to more government oversight, or they will sign on to more government oversight, they say. They've also lost tons of sponsors. So I think that we're about to see what will come. I think we're still seeing the effects of this big impact that they're feeling for the first time, which isn't just a loss of reputation, but it's a loss of you know, financial stability, really, when it comes to having giant corporations that are partners back away and no longer wanting to be associated with your brand. So I think there's been criticisms on sort of on the past and on the sort of institutionalized nature of how these things are dealt with. But rolling forward, some serious questions are going to be asked about where things go from here.
I think a lot of people have gone, Dan, from suggesting maybe it's necessary for Hockey Canada to in essence, be quote unquote burned to the ground, a new logo, a new administration, a new name for it, a full on rebrand, to the point where they're like, not only was it suggested maybe 4 or 5 weeks ago, in a way, especially after Friday, Dan, it almost feels inevitable. Have you sort of crossed that Rubicon and would you say something like that is inevitable, that it can't just remain as is?
Well, back when I was looking at the story before, when Scotiabank announced that it was pausing its funding, and then all of the other corporations, Tim Hortons and Canadian Tire and others, sort of, at that moment, when I first was mentioning to a colleague that I think this is existential for Hockey Canada. I don't know that before it was, I thought that there was sort of a sense of, okay, well, we've lost some funding from the government, but, you know, if we say the right answers, change our code of conduct, we can get through this. But now the pressure is coming from all sides. And so I do think that, you know, we'll see over the next couple of days what kind of pressure continues to come from the parliamentary hearing. But I do think that, you know, I would be astounded if some sort of fundamental change within the organization doesn't occur, just given the amount of pressure that is facing and you know, and the needs, the legitimate needs we're seeing, you know, as these allegations come forward about, you know, what might need to happen in terms of, you know, governing, you know, the most beloved sport in our country.
I know your story with Katie and Ian published on Friday, same day as the Halifax revelations, that, you know, that they're just unbelievably disturbting that TSN's Rick West had uncovered. How did that change some of the conversation? Because now you know this is not truly a one-off. Now you know that this is not just something that, and it's hard to believe that anybody that would participate in something like this would just do it once. But it's sort of really upped the public anger and rancor, demanding not just answers but accountability.
Well, I think it's significant that these, you know, allegations span, you know, 15 years. I mean, you're going from allegations that involve that potentially involve people that are now in the NHL at a young age and are just starting their careers. And this is going back to people who would be at the end of their careers or are already retired, allegedly. And so in terms of what happened there. And so previous to the story we had written on the weekend about what happened in London, back in June, Katie, Ian, and I did a big story looking at sort of the history of sexual violence in hockey, and particularly in junior hockey, and at all levels of how these situations have been dealt with in the past. And there's a very, you know, the history is not surprising. It's something that if you were to go back 30 years, you can just do a newspaper search and you find a story repeating and repeating. And so, you know, as shocking and as horrific as the allegations are, I think it underscores a sense that this was these allegations are not just a one-off. I mean, even in the parliamentary hearing, Tom Rennie and Scott Smith were discussing the fact that they receive several sexual assault allegations a year, and they deal with these within Hockey Canada. And so this is something that I think for it was as shocking as it was, just really sort of solidified a reality of this is a systemic problem within perhaps the organization, but also in junior hockey culture at large.
Massively so. You can read them on The Athletic, on the app, or at theathletic.com. Dan Robson, thanks so much for the time today. I greatly appreciate you hooking up with us.
Thanks, Greg.
Hey, really appreciate you listening to the podcast today. Thanks so much for finding us. We have a live show tomorrow on Tuesday between 5:30 and 9 a.m. You can hear it at 640toronto.com on AM 640 on your radio dial, or of course on the Radio Player Canada app. That's at Radio Player CA on Twitter, and you'll find the app there. Download it. Easy to find us and all our other great shows. Thank you again so much. We'll see you soon.
I'm not just a pawn in this game.
3 nights a week on Global.
They're putting targets on their back. Massive.
Drama.
I guess you could say I'm in a showman.
They're just so in love and so annoying. Enough.
Betrayal.
The guy just put up his best friend now.
And plot twists.
What is happening right now?
You'll never see coming.
If you're coming for me,
this is perfect.
I'm coming for you then.
It'll be a battle.
Like, it'll be war.
Big Brother Canada. All new Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Sundays on Global. Stream on Stack TV.